saving money in your next project when you shop at Menards. We have everything you need for keeping your outdoor power equipment in tip-top shape. Ensure your lawnmower or boat is running smooth this year. Right now, all FVP lawn and garden and marine batteries are on sale. View our entire selection of FVP batteries today on Menards.com. Plus, check out our weekly flyer for all of the great deals happening this week.
Save big money at Menards.
Save big money on everything you need at Menards. Your roof is the first line of defense against the elements, and it enhances the appearance of your home's exterior. Owens Corning shingles offer ultimate protection and impressive curb appeal. Choose from 26 colors of Owens Corning Duration shingles and transform your home today. Shop our selection of roofing products on Menards.com. Plus, check out our weekly flyer and find plenty of great deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.
He is, you know, up in the middle of the night posting weird stuff.
Well, he does sleep at cabinet meetings.
Yeah, he falls asleep at cabinet meetings. Exactly. He gets his little cat nap at the cabinet meetings.
Welcome to the Mona Charon Show. I am delighted you've joined us today. This is a special edition of the show. We are having a reunion of the Beg to Differ panel. So I'm delighted to welcome back Damon Linker, who writes the Substack newsletter Notes from the Middle Ground, Bill Galston of the Wall Street Journal and Brookings Institution, and Linda Chavez, who is now vice chair of the Renewed Democracy Initiative and the host of a new podcast called Older Wiser. Love that title, Linda. Welcome, one and all. It's great to see you guys.
Yeah, it's great to be back.
We have a lot of ground to cover. Things have happened since we were last together. So let's start with the good news. Over the weekend, Viktor Orban was dealt a decisive defeat. Bill, I'm going to start with you. The meaning of the Orban loss in Hungary.
First of all, you know, what happened was really stunning. Right? A party that didn't exist 2 years ago, led by a man who was part of Orban's government 2 years ago, just won, depending on which metric you're looking at, between 53 and 54% of the popular vote, and between 136 and 138 seats in the 199-seat Hungarian legislature, more than two-thirds, and therefore enough for this new party not only to win, but also to reverse some of the noxious constitutional changes that Viktor Orban made. What's its significance? Well, you know, one part of the answer is that if you ignore the economic condition of your people, you know, if you allow your economy to go year after year with no growth, if you allow inflation to average 9% per annum, which it has in Hungary, you know, since 2021, for a total of 57%, more than twice the American inflation, which the American people have found intolerable, you are likely to become less popular than you'd like to be. And so Orban just took his eye off the ball. And the second thing that happened was that the stench of cronyism and corruption became overpowering and became an incredible source of vulnerability among the people who saw that Viktor Orban had become exactly what he set out to replace. And instead, they chose as his replacement a 45-year-old who looked like a younger, slimmer, and more energetic image of what Viktor Orban had been when he began in Hungarian politics. I could go on, but I think
I would ask you to go on one point, if you would, and that is the connection between authoritarianism and corruption.
Well, it's very intimate. Because one aspect of authoritarian regimes is that they tend to co-opt the private sector as well as the media, which in many cases is part of the private sector. And, you know, so you have a series of intimate transactional relationships between the captains of corporations and industry on the one hand and the government is on the other. And it's a mutually supportive relationship because the corporations get a preferred position and the government gets a cut of the take. So this is a pattern you see very widely in authoritarian regimes. And regrettably, it can happen even in democracies that may be on their way to a greater measure of authoritarianism, such as the United States, where transactional politics is now the name of the game.
Linda, can you talk a little bit about what Viktor Orban meant to the MAGA right in this country and the implications for the MAGA movement more generally?
Well, first of all, he was the hero to many intellectuals on the right. There are a number of people who've actually gone to work in Hungary for him. The NatCons, National Conservatives, who hold a once-a-year conference and who have a very, very different idea of American security and where America's place should be in the rule, have gravitated to him. So he represents
and CPAC. Don't forget CPAC.
That's right, CPAC as well. So there's really he's really been the hero of, as I say, the intellectual MAGA movement. Those words seem like an oxymoron, but there are some intellectuals who
we did a whole podcast with Laura Field, who wrote
yes,
a book called Furious Minds, which talks about the there are MAGA intellectuals, however dishonest and crazy they may be.
Right. So at any rate, so I think it means that the other thing is, I think there's some hopeful news in this for those of us in this on the center right who are very worried about what Trump is doing to this country, because he was following in the footsteps of Orban, the cronyism that Bill just talked about. That is, you know, absolutely rife in this government, with the U.S. under Trump now taking interest in certain companies, getting money, getting, a place at the table within corporations. So that has not fared very well. And so I think this really is, there's hope in that, but there's also hope in the sense that we talk a lot about authoritarianism and are we becoming an authoritarian country? There is, I think, a difference between an old-fashioned authoritarian regime and an illiberal democracy. And one of the things that Hungary proved is that, democracy can still win out. Even in an illiberal democracy, you can vote the bums out. And that's what they did to Viktor Orban.
Damon, it's going to be a challenge. Let's talk a little bit about Peter Magyar. I looked it up on Google. I thought, how do you pronounce this correctly? Because I thought Magyar means Hungarian, right? But that's, according to Mr. Google, the proper pronunciation is Magyar. So he, by the way, is not a liberal. I mean, he's not on to the left side of the spectrum ideologically. He's more a center right guy. And he didn't run to Orban's left very much on things like immigration. It's interesting. But he did play up the fact that Orban had become a total Putin stooge. And he did stress pocketbook issues and corruption. You've talked a lot in our past podcasts about the great urban-rural divide. You and Bill have both mentioned this many times. That is seems to be global, a global phenomenon. Did Peter Magyar managed to pick that lock? I mean, he campaigned out in the countryside. He didn't spend that much time in Budapest. He was out in the country. Is that hopeful about breaking down that wall?
It certainly is one path to winning, and I think it is a smart path, and I hope Democrats follow it when we head into the 2028 election. And it's a path that actually Donald Tusk in Poland marched two or three years ago. It's the same strategy, which is in effect, now he, Tusk is a center left figure, and you're right that Magyar is not. He's center right. But this is sort of the equivalent in our country if a Democrat were running and they ran basically like a 50-year-old Mitt Romney as a Democrat, and his campaign consisted of going to red states in rural areas and going from town to town, church to church, endlessly for months, speaking to people, listening to them, not complaining that Trump has rigged the system, he's stealing our power, we need to defeat authoritarianism. Although, of course, that is the subtext and a lot of the truth of the matter, but not as a theme of the speech. The speech is about you, your lives here. What are you struggling with? How are you making do in this economy that is not doing well under our current leader? How can I defend you and take your complaints and problems to Washington to make your life better? And then when the Trump successor tries to bait that candidate, the Democrat, the 50-year-old Mitt Romney person, by passing an extremely draconian anti-LGBTQ law, not taking the bait, not bringing it up. When a reporter says, "Oh, Mr. Young Mitt Romney, what do you think of this that the Republicans have passed?" say, "That's not really my issue. I'm not concerned about that at the moment. We're concerned about people's daily lives and how the current government is hurting them economically." Just staying on message, not taking the bait, not picking up issues that divide Democrats and unite the right. So in all of these respects, I think Magyar's strategy and approach is a really great one, and I hope to see Democrats follow it. It is a path, I think, to what could be a really resounding victory. I mean, I think both Linda and Bill have noted the margin was remarkable, really a big success in a system that had been rigged by Orban. Absolutely. So that if it had only been like 51% of the vote in certain districts aligning in a certain way, it would have been a very, very narrow victory. And instead, they won enough that all of the things that Orban and his party put into the law to give themselves an advantage tipped the exact opposite way. And yeah. So you ended up with a victory in the mid-50s actually being, in terms of representation, a really decisive supermajoritarian victory. So again, thumbs up on all of that.
Yeah. As I think Bill mentioned already, this two-thirds majority gives the new government the ability to amend the Constitution, because under Orban, the Constitution was amended a number of times to make Hungary less and less of a democracy in a lot of ways. And so they're going to have to, had they not achieved a two-thirds majority, it would have been much more difficult to try to undo some of that damage. Now, at least it's possible. Whether it will happen remains to be seen. Bill, we should probably dwell for a minute here on the fact that we had, who were the people in some cases literally stumping for Orban in the case of J.D. Vance, but you had the alliance of Putin's Russia and Trump's U.S. behind Orban. It is a remarkable thing, right?
Oh, absolutely. But this indicates one of the things that I consider to be a verity of democratic politics, that when you're dealing with things that you only know through the speech of others, you know it in a mediated way, you can be persuaded that the sky is purple. But when you're dealing with things like local corruption, economic stagnation, the decay of public services, you can see those for yourself. And it's much harder either for domestic or external spinners to to be able to persuade you that the sky is purple when you're looking out your window and it isn't. And that is the force of the palpable issues in politics, because they enable people to say with confidence, my situation is worse than it was, worse than I want it to be. And it's attributable to the people who are in power. We're going to get rid of them. Let me make one other point. I think Magyar, however it's correctly pronounced, illustrated something that I've believed for a long time. And that is the best way to defend democracy is not to talk about the erosion of democracy. It is to win a big enough victory to protect it and improve it where it needs to be improved. And, and that's one of the lessons that in the Wall Street Journal piece I published today, I point out to Democrats, don't do that. Go for a big majority. And that means, as Damon says, not taking the debate, not getting diverted from your core message about what's going on in people's lives that needs to be improved. And, I am praying, as Damon is, that my party will take the hint, because it's a pretty broad hint. The other point I want to make is that we've now seen the two European countries that seem to be careening towards autocracy brought back onto the democratic path through democratic elections, which is why it was so significant that Viktor Orban conceded quickly and graciously. He didn't even seem to be tempted to pull a Trump. And why it's so important, that the integrity of our own elections here at home be protected and defended by all means possible. Because if the people, as Linda said, can express their will, then eventually it will work out okay. But if they can't, then we're really in big trouble.
Yeah, exactly. Linda, can you say a few words about the meaning of this outcome for Ukraine?
Well, it's very good news for Ukraine because, of course, Orban leaned to Putin. So that's going to be very significant. It really now puts Hungary with all of the Europeans in opposing this war of aggression by Russia.
Removes a veto also of aid for Ukraine.
That's right. Removes the veto of aid. But all of that is wonderful and we're all very pleased, but it cannot make up for the fact that this administration has undercut Ukraine at every move, that they have actively done things to help Russia, including, by the way, lifting sanctions on Russian oil, because of what's going on in Iran and the Strait of Hormuz. But Russia, their economy has been, teetering during the last several months. And now there's, a sudden infusion of money. I do want to pick up something more about the immigration issue and how that played out in Hungary, because I think there are important lessons for both Democrats and Republicans in what happened in Hungary. A lot of people like to make the comparison, Hungary, he came to power, Orban, because of anti-immigrant feeling. Immigration in Europe, particularly in the period that, brought Orban to the heights of power, is very different than immigration in the United States. You have a very, very generous social welfare system because of the European Union. Once somebody steps foot in any country the European Union, they can then more or less move freely about. And Hungary, under Orban, put a stop to that. And it's clear that closing the border to Syrians and others was dramatically successful for Orban, and Magyar has not repudiated that. He, in fact, comes out of that same sentiment. It's very different than what's going on here in the United States. I think people elected Trump believing that he was going to close the border, which he has very successfully done. We give him credit for that. But there was not the kind of, you know, witch hunts and going after, you know, your neighbors and the guy who works at your restaurant in Hungary, as there has been in the United States. So I know, you know, Republicans like to point to the European example on immigration, but their immigration and our immigration are really quite different.
Damon, we should also just say for the record that this was the highest voter turnout that there has been in Hungary since the fall of communism, 1989. So the people were incredibly energized, which is, I guess, a hopeful sign as well. Maybe we should end this segment by just underlining something that has already come up, but maybe you want to say a few more words about it, which is Magyar was running against corruption, about the cost of living and about education. Those were the big issues that he kept hammering. And he did not explicitly say, I'm here to save our democracy. I guess the question is the lesson that the voters really aren't going to be receptive to let's save democracy as a voting message, that you have to downplay that or it does no good for you. You might as well just do what Magyar did.
Well, I already think the evidence is overwhelming that it doesn't work. I mean, it might not hurt in certain situations, but it certainly is not the magic bullet. And we saw that in Hillary Clinton's campaign in 2016. Biden won in 2020, so the evidence was a little mixed there, but it certainly didn't work for Harris in 2024, whose campaign ended with references to fascism and so forth. And it's not that the problem, I think, is it needs to be concrete. These are like abstract arguments that intellectuals like all of us are eager to sink our teeth into. But for voters, it needs to be put in concrete terms. And so in some ways, Magyar's emphasis on corruption was a version of him bringing up that very issue, but not in the abstract terms of save our democracy. It was, this guy has changed our system so that he and his cronies are walking away with money, and that is hurting you. Mm-hmm. And the fact is, I mean, you know, kind of to couch this point in a little bit broader terms that I care a lot about, I don't see any reason, at least in theory, why a politics that in terms of actual policy preferences could be aligned with this kind of populist right. Now, I might not vote for it, but a politician who says we need to have cuts in immigration, we need to deport people, we need protectionism to protect American business, we need a different kind of foreign policy that's more focused on American national interests, more narrowly defined. There's no reason why that politics needs to entail, and I need to become a thug who uses the system to enrich myself and my family, and I'm going to demand of corporations that I'm going to either badmouth them and hurt them economically if they don't do my bidding. I'm going to use the institutions of the regulatory state to hurt them if they don't march behind me and give me tribute, and so forth, and you know, all the way through domestic and foreign policy. In other words, Trump. Trump is uniquely terrible. This latest example of Orban very graciously conceding on the night of the election with no question that he would accept the results show once again, as terrible as Orban is, as much as he rigged the system to benefit himself, as much as he was a true illiberal who kicked universities out of the country and persecuted lesbian and gay and transsexual people.
And tried to silence opposition press.
Right. On
did
and
silence
on and on.
It.
Yeah. I mean, shut down opposition media so that basically if you weren't a member of his party, you couldn't get your message out through any media. All of it and more. Mm-hmm. In the end, he saw the results and said, all right, I lost. It's over. That means that in the end, it was, when push came to shove, more of a Democrat than Donald Trump is, because he will not and has never done that, conceded a loss. He is far more dangerous than any other iteration of this politics. And that, to bring back to the point I was making, it should be possible, if this is the new alignment of, say, what the right now is in opposition to the center-left and liberal democracies around the world, can't we have a version of that that actually is willing to play by the normal rules of winning and losing and coming back to try to win again and competing fairly and not rigging the system to enrich yourself? It should be possible. Let's hope for that. That's my hopeful version of a linker take.
Well, speaking of our crazy president, let's now move to the topic of the Iran war. The president is, let's just say that the layers of incoherence pile up the more you examine how the messaging, as we got into the war, as it was progressing. So as everybody remembers, the initial messaging was, this is going to be a very short war. We are going to decapitate the regime and there's going to be regime change. Rise up and take your country, the president said. First, he said help is on the way many months before, and it didn't come. Then he said, rise up and take your country. And he said he would accept nothing but unconditional surrender. And he said he wanted to choose the next Iranian leader. then he said, we need to continue fighting because we have to eliminate their nuclear capacity, which capacity he claimed had been completely obliterated 8 months before. I could go on. You know all this, and our listeners know all this. So let's start with this question first. Are we losing? Have we lost the war in Iran, and now the rest is we've got this sort of tap dance of pretend negotiations, but it's really trying to hide the fact that Trump launched something. It was ill-considered. It was poorly executed, and not by the U.S. military, but because of the lack of strategy. It failed to topple the regime and, of course, empowered Iran by giving them control, showing them that they could use the Strait of Hormuz this way. Oh, God. And then there was that moment where he said we would go in with the Iranians on a joint venture to toll the Strait of Hormuz. Wow. Okay. So, Bill, what do you make of it all?
What do I make of it all? Well, you did a very good job of summarizing the incoherence in the president's statements. Have we lost the war? I think that's a premature judgment. One thing we can say for sure is that we have failed to achieve any of the ever-shifting objections that President Trump has stated as the justification and aim of the war. The second thing I feel comfortable in saying is that if the conflict ends with the Iranians in control of the Strait of Hormuz, then we will have lost relative to where we were when the war started, because that will give them a chokehold on the global economy.
Yeah.
And you better believe that they're going to take advantage of that in order to get the revenue that they need in order to rebuild their country and to sustain the Revolutionary Guards. So, analytically, the next question is, the president, having decided he wasn't willing to pay the cost of reopening it through a land invasion of Karg Island and the southwest border of Iran,
which you would need to prevent them from firing down on ships in the Strait of Hormuz.
From a military standpoint, and I talked about this in a series of columns, it would have been very tough with the forces that the president was willing to deploy and able to deploy. He decided, instead of opening it at prohibitive cost, to shut it down entirely at enormous cost to the world economy, more than to the American economy. Our Asian, our Asian allies are going nuts. And I have talked to people from Australia and New Zealand who say that their fuel stocks are, you know, can be measured in weeks, and they have no idea what they're going to do if they run out. So the question is, who is going to buckle first? The, you know, the total embargo will hurt the Iranian economy a lot, but it'll also hurt us and our allies a lot. And it's a race with clocks running at different speeds in the different countries. And I have no idea, you know, how the balance is going to shift as the embargo goes on. But it's going to be a very uncomfortable and risky period, not only for us, but for everybody who depends on an open Persian Gulf.
Linda, wars are, as someone once said, are a contest of wills. And it is not a question of who has more armaments necessarily. It can be a question of who's willing to endure more pain. And the Iranian regime, it demonstrated just as recently as January that it is willing to kill up to 30,000 of its own people and torment others to maintain itself in power. So there is absolutely no reason this regime cannot impose pain on the Iranian people for the end of keeping itself in power. Whereas the U.S., facing pressure from our domestic population, which did not want this war, does not support this war, and therefore is highly resistant to paying any price, especially gas prices. It seems that when, you know, first Trump attempted through military means, Trump and the Israelis, who I think also made a horrible mistake here. And by the way, apparently lots of Israelis feel that way too, that this was a mistake. So he attempted through bombing to get Iran to buckle, and it didn't. And so now he's saying, well, now I'm going to impose economic pressure, which is what we were doing before we started bombing them. And he's thinking that he's going to win this encounter. How do you think that works out?
Well, first of all, I have to admit to all of you that when the bombing first started, I was in favor of it. I thought this is a good thing. I'm glad we're going to do this. It's important for the United States and even more important for Israel. But I also said that my only worry is Trump will screw it up. And of course he has. And that is the problem. That the idea of getting rid of Iran's ability to build nuclear weapons, destroying their military, degrading the IRGC, all of those have good strategic interests for the United States. We would like to accomplish all those. But because of the way in which he's conducted it, his erratic behavior, the way he changes his mind on a whim, and most importantly, the failure to immediately realized that the Strait of Hormuz was going to become a problem. I mean, I'm not a military expert, but I know how to look at a map and I know how many ships come through that strait. And I'm, you know, you don't have to be a military genius to figure out, cut that off and you're going to have a huge leverage point.
We haven't repealed geography.
No, or economics, or you mentioned at the beginning, who's going to have the will to stay in this fight longer? Let me just say that any country that is being invaded or being attacked by an outside force is going to have more skin in the game and more incentive to continue to fight. We're seeing that in Ukraine. Russia mm-hmm. should have defeated Ukraine long ago. It hasn't happened. And so you're also dealing here with what amounts to a totalitarian system. It goes beyond authoritarian. And their only interest, their single interest, is in remaining in control. And once we gave up the idea of regime change, we weren't doing what I hoped we were doing, which would be to be backing the Kurds and others who might rise up and be able to take on the regime. We didn't do any of that. And now we don't even mention that as a goal. I mean, they pretend that having a possibly comatose son of the Ayatollah in charge is regime change. Of course, it's not. So all of this bodes very ill. And my fear is they are now talking about reopening negotiations. I don't know, by the time we finish recording this podcast, it may have changed in the hour long we have here. But if they reopen negotiations, and if now the debate is whether or not they're going to hold off for 5 years or 20 years, where does that put us back? That puts us back to the Obama deal, the JCPOA, which I, by the way, I was opposed to because I knew they would never abide by it. So, you know, it's been a terrible loss in blood and treasure, inflicted enormous, enormous suffering on the people of Iran. So I'm not hopeful.
It's not only inflicted suffering on the people of Iran, Damon, and that bombing of a school for girls was just agonizing at the very first hours of the war. But it's not only inflicted suffering on Iran. It has damaged, not that we were in great shape with our allies anyway, because of the nature of this administration, saber rattling against NATO, claiming that it might want to invade Canada and Greenland and Panama and everywhere else, but also, raising the oil prices and access to fertilizer and lots of other things for all of the world and many of our important allies, erstwhile allies. Who knows if they still consider us an ally, and I wouldn't blame them if they didn't. And finally, the other thing is that it has ignited what was already simmering, this explosion of hatred of Israel. And, you know, Israel has to take its own share of blame for that. But by the awful messaging of saying, well, we only did this because basically the Israelis dragged us into it, our Secretary of State saying that, you know, it's given fodder to the worst anti-Semites to say, you see, we're being led around the nose by the Jews.
Yes, all of the above. I mean, my place on the podcast on foreign policy was often as a bit of an outlier. This was minimized a little bit from February 2022 on because I was in favor of aiding Ukraine, which put me kind of back on team, which I supported that very strongly for, you know, pro-NATO reasons. It's on the border of NATO and a threat. You know, I thought that Putin should be made to pay an extremely high price for flouting the stricture on cross-border aggression and so forth. But I do not support regime change as a strategic goal in American foreign policy. I opposed the Iraq war. I opposed the Libyan intervention. I did not think we should be more involved in the Syrian civil war. And so guess what I thought about this? very, very bad. I was not happy about this at all, even before one contemplated, oh my God, it's Donald Trump doing this. What does that mean about how successful this is going to be? I mean, say what you will about the Bush 43 administration and it's the mistakes it made and the exaggeration about some intelligence, but those were highly competent people who actually meant well and thought that they were going to improve America's strategic situation in the region and around the world and would help to spread a representative democratic government to Iraq. And that didn't work out well, but I mean,
they do have a better government than Saddam was. But
yes, after you know, 6 or 7 years of bloodletting and hundreds of thousands of dead.
No, fair enough. We can argue about whether the price was too high. Actually, right. I wouldn't. But at the same time, I think we shouldn't say it was a complete failure because it wasn't.
Okay, I will leave that aside for now. But okay. But I will say that one reason in our current context with Trump leading this is, like, even leaving aside my more general, you know, resistance to pursuing regime change as a policy, is that this is an incredible act of revisionism in international relations. You're a revisionist power if you seek to undermine or even destroy the current order of security arrangements in the world as they stand. So Putin is a revisionist leader leading a revisionist power. China is also in its way a revisionist power. Both of them are not happy with the American-led world order, the liberal international order, and seek to act in ways to weaken it because that increases their own ability to redefine and shift that order in a direction that they think will be more favorable to them. Trump has always aspired to undermine this order, but he is now acting in ways that both directly and then in knock-on consequences are very significantly undermining that order. And that is terrible for the United States to be acting as a revisionist power to undermine the system that we built and have policed ever since the end of World War II, and especially post-Cold War. So, I mean, I find it completely outrageous what has happened with our relationship with NATO, which, as you said, has been very much undermined by Trump threatening to invade a NATO power where they actually put troops on the ground to defend themselves against an American invasion force that they rightly feared as a possibility. That's one thing. That's a threat that no one knew whether he would actually follow through on. But for setting up a series of events that has now led the Strait of Hormuz to be closed, and for Trump to demand that NATO powers effectively come in and clean up his mess for him, and when they very reasonably refuse to use that as evidence to further his longstanding goal of us removing ourselves from NATO.
And by the way, he didn't even consult with NATO before he started this war.
Of course not. He didn't even give them a call as a courtesy right. the night as that the actual bombs were falling. It is just a travesty. Now, one last note at the end of all of that very, very negative take on all of this. I will say, as dangerous as it is, I have the first time in this whole episode a modicum of respect for this latest tactical gambit of how do we get Iran to stop blocking the strait and only letting its favorable friendly powers through and insisting that all economic exchange take place in yuan rather than dollars, which is also very ruinous for the dollarization of the global financial economy. This idea that we're going to respond to that by us closing it down entirely is so crazy that it just might work. if Trump actually sticks to it, it's the first time that I've thought, you know, this is where Trump's like totally going outside of all norms and boxes and kind of shifting, completely reversing the Iranian tactics mm-hmm. on them and causing them pain from this gambit of theirs. That's the first time that I've thought, like, maybe this guy is so crazy that in this one instance, this could work. Not that it necessarily will, but versus all the other options.
I guess then it didn't make you think as it made me think of the scene from Blazing Saddles where the guy holds
well,
the gun
to his
own head.
It sort of did, but even that could sometimes work in the right circumstance. This is my kind of Aristotelian prudence at work. Like maybe in this particular circumstance,
maybe
reversing the tactic on...
If it weren't, Damon, for the possibility, likelihood, certainty of a worldwide recession, if it lasts long enough, I mean, that's the problem.
It's bad, but it was going to be bad anyway. Like, so that's how I'm judging this, that like we had no other way out of this.
Let me interject a note here. And this is sort of a reflection on and a modification of something that Linda said. When it comes to the bombing of Iran, I don't think it's a case of Trump screwing it up. I think the bombing campaign was as good as the bombing campaign could have been. And he wasn't like LBJ sitting in the Oval Office choosing bombing targets. You know, he allowed the armed forces, particularly the Air Force, to execute the plan that they had devised. The problem wasn't the tactics. The problem was the theory.
Yeah.
Because what guided the effort was the belief that if you bombed them long enough and hard enough, the regime would fall.
Well, actually, no, Bill, I have to amend that. Their theory was if you bomb them sharply for a first few days and you knock off the entire, you know, leadership, they'll fold like a cheap tent, that it was all going to be quick and easy.
Okay, but then let's assume that after the first week or so, they saw that it wasn't going to be so quick and so easy. Then the point is we've got to keep it up until the pressure and the damage become unbearable for them. The problem was the theory of regime change from the air. And anybody, you know, any military strategist would have told you that. Interestingly, you know, and, you know, a footnote to what Damon said, this policy is actually the policy recommended by Richard Haass, the former chair of the, you know, of the Council on Foreign Relations. So in a way, it's a pretty mainstream response, and illustrating Churchill's dictum, you know, that you can always count on the Americans to do the right thing after they've exhausted all of the alternatives. Whether this turns out to be the right thing, I don't know. That depends on the relative pressure. But what we're doing in the process is demonstrating our utter indifference to the well-being of any country other than the United States. And we're going to pay a huge price for this.
And also, you know, we are seen as an aggressive, rapacious power.
You don't need to persuade me.
Just like our buddies in the Kremlin. So that's all great. Let me just respond, Damon, if you wouldn't mind, to the point about regime change, because, you know, there was a time many years ago when I would have said, yes, we should be trying for regime change because Iran is such a bad actor and the whole Middle East would be different if not for this noxious influence. They are the chief sponsor of terrorism, on and on and on. And of course, they oppress their own people to a marked degree. So it would be great if there were a different regime in Tehran, and I would have been in favor. But I would not have said, so let's bomb them from the air, because you cannot change a regime by bombing it from the air. It's never happened. And so, you know, so what could you do? You can use soft power. You know, the regime keeps turning off the internet so that people can't talk to one another and plot and scheme to resist the regime. We could have helped with, you know, communications. There's all kinds of ways to help them communicate. There are other ways you could have attempted to undermine that regime that are not military that I would have been in favor of, would have, I say. But with this presidency, with this MAGA, these lunatics in charge, I wouldn't even have been in favor of that because we can't control our own regime right now. So I think for us to be going and trying to change anybody else's at this point is too much. We have to change our own. Okay, one more. Before we leave this topic altogether, we have to talk. Well, actually, it blends in because the next thing I want to talk about is Trump as Jesus. And so we do have to talk a little bit, I think, about Trump's mental state and what's happening there. The blood-curdling threats to commit genocide, basically, to say he was going to destroy an entire civilization, gave us the incredible spectacle of the president of the United States threatening genocide and Alex Jones and Marjorie Taylor Greene sounding more sane than the commander in chief. Linda?
Yes.
Where
exactly.
Are we on this?
Well, there are just so many things to unpack in this issue. We elected Donald Trump in part, I think, because of a large number of Americans looked at the Biden presidency, looked at him and his mental state failing and wanted to change, and they didn't.
Biden's, that is.
I'm sorry, who did I say?
No, you said his, but I want to make clear.
Biden's, yes, Biden's. This terrible thing about this is that we see it every single day. And if you monitor his Truth Social postings, most of the absolutely craziest come between the hours of 12 a.m. and 4 a.m. Mm-hmm. So this is a man who's the leader of the free world, the president, the commander in chief, and he's not sleeping at all. He is, you know, up in the middle of the night posting weird stuff, including.
Well, he does sleep at cabinet meetings.
Yeah, he falls asleep at cabinet meetings. Exactly. He gets his little cat nap at the cabinet meetings. This is scary. And there is no chance in hell that his cabinet is going to invoke the 25th Amendment. And even if they did, there's no chance that the Republicans in the Congress, which after a certain number of days would have to essentially validate, he's not going to be removed. This is really scary. I mean, mm-hmm. this is a man who is absolutely delusional. You know, posting himself as Jesus, the only thing that that showed about him is that he has absolutely no familiarity with Christianity whatsoever, because he would know that that was, you know, blasphemous, that there is no believing Christian or even people of other faith who would see that as, you know, a positive thing. So he's just off his rocker. He's getting older. He clearly has cognitive decline. And what are we going to do about it? I don't think there's anything we can do about it. And oh, by the way, if we did do something about it, we'd have J.D. Vance as president. Does anybody really think that would be a better thing? I'm not sure.
Yes.
Oh, you do?
I do. Okay. I do. As much as I despise J.D.
Well, but
Vance.
Then he might be elected.
He's not. I doubt it. But anyway, whatever. I mean, the fact is he isn't insane.
No, he's just craven.
But Bill, one of the things that we established, I think beyond peradventure in the first term, is that the constitutional remedy for a president who is out of control is a dead letter. That impeachment doesn't work. And so the Constitution is not equal to the task. We were just talking about Hungary and that the voters in the end, if they can still vote freely, can lift a country out of autocracy. But in the meantime, we have a system that cannot cope, correct?
Well, it depends on how you define the system. The system, it seems to me, has two parts. One is the language of the Constitution. The other is the nature of the legislative body that actually has to execute the Constitution. And the problem, I believe, is not with the former, it's the latter. And as I've said many times, the framers of the Constitution didn't expect a party system. They didn't want a party system. They got a party system within 5 years after the Constitution went into operation.
At the hands of some of the founders themselves, but anyway.
Yeah, well, very much
like
so.
Like Madison and Jefferson.
Yes, but John Adams didn't help much, but yeah. we can duke that one out.
Wouldn't it be fun if we only had to debate about that?
Yeah, absolutely. And so there has been a tension between the Constitution and the party system ever since. And that tension, which reached a cyclical peak in the 1850s, has now, I think, reached another cyclical peak that, like that one, puts the actual workability of the constitutional system into question. And impeachment is one of the first victims of, it's one of the first mechanisms to fail when hyperpartisanship takes over. And so I do think at this point, the only remedy for a situation like this is the ballot box. You know, you don't see the 25th Amendment. Linda doesn't. Nobody does. It won't happen. I don't see an impeachment succeeding at this point. And so what you see is what you get until we have an election. I don't know what else to say. And we are not going to amend the Constitution anytime soon to make it easier to remove the President of the United States, period, full stop. So bottom line, Madison was a genius, but there's not an institutional solution for every problem.
Yeah. Damon, can we talk a little more about the whole religion thing? This administration has sort of put on the armor of crusaders. Pete Hegseth talks about fighting for God. They he invited a preacher who is known as a white supremacist and misogynist and all kinds of things to speak at the Pentagon. And now the president is engaging in a full-on attack on Pope Leo, which is, maybe more evidence of how crazy he is. But is it also perhaps part of the crack-up of the MAGA world that, you know, there's only so many fissures that you can, open in these seams, right? I mean, some probably significant portion of the MAGA base is Christian, but really Christian, like really Catholic or really Protestant. It will not like the Trump blasphemy. And of course, the outright fight with the Pope. I just don't see how that can be good for him. How bad is it?
I'll get to that in a sec. I just want to say one quick thing about the institutional question that you guys were talking about. Just add one thing to that. I'm going to do the rarest of things when this group gets together and actually sound slightly optimistic. Now, I'm not really making a prediction, simply playing out one possible series of events. The trajectory of his approval rating is very interesting and quite different than the first time. First time he went down very rapidly to his all-time low. Within 6 months, he was at his all-time low. And then over the next 3 years, he very, very slowly came back up so that when we got to the 2020 election, he was around 43-44% approval. This time, he started sinking more slowly, hovered around in that same area, around 44-43. And now, through the series of blows over the last several months with the economy, with ICE and its murderous tactics, and now with the war, he's just going down, down, down. If that continues, if gas prices go up, inflation goes up, we head into a recession, the midterms are a bloodbath where the Democrats manage to eke out a victory even in the Senate, in addition to winning a couple dozen seats in the House, and he's going down and down. We've already started to see some MAGA, core MAGA influencers, Tim Pool, attacking Trump the other day, plus the war with all of the, all of the kind of the MAGA core Tucker Carlson quadrant people. If this just keeps spinning out and he's more erratically, all of the religious stuff that I'll get to in a second, it is conceivable that 6 months after this bloodbath of the midterms, he's now down to an unprecedented low 30s, maybe, where we're actually seeing his core cultish supporters finally leaving him behind, where actual impeachment as we head toward 2028 and the Republicans are in panic about the destruction of the viability of their party, where maybe they actually might move against him and remove him. It's conceivable. It's what percentage? 20% chance, maybe, on a happy day? I don't know. Bill's saying down thumb. I agree. Probably not going to happen. But for the very first time in both terms, I can imagine a scenario where it could conceivably take place if everything lines up right. Now, briefly on the religion thing, Trump's losing it. I mean, he doesn't know what he's doing. He's desperate, although he continues to lie delusionally about how popular he is. He knows the truth that he's down. He's flailing. He's stuck in the Iran war. He doesn't know how to get out. He knows that inflation is up and that he doesn't know what to do about it. And so he's flailing. He thinks his old tactic of continually going to like far right memes will somehow help him. And so he quickly, without thinking, shared that one of himself as the healing Jesus. it's crazy. And then attacking the Pope, thinking that like his supporters would like that because he thinks he can make American partisanship override absolutely every other attachment on the planet. It's
well, you know, the Pope is very weak on crime.
Yeah, he's very weak on crime. Exactly. It's just crazy. But it is, I will say, it is downstream of something that I've written and talked about many times in this era, which is the evolution of what I wrote about 20 years ago with the religious right as it existed under George W. Bush, where for all the criticisms I have of those people, and I am a notable critic of them, that they were genuinely motivated by real faith. They were Bible reading, very devout Protestants and Catholics who believed this stuff and genuinely wanted to bring those commitments into politics and improve things that way. That's where I broke from them and not thinking that it did that. But
in some ways it did. PEPFAR was a great thing. But
oh,
anyway.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. To the extent that that's a consequence of it, I agree wholeheartedly. And it's a mixed bag, clearly, especially in retrospect. But what the Trump era of the religious right is a much nastier thing, where the secularization of America and the secularization of the Republican electoral coalition has produced a form of the religious right that is often not for everyone, but for a lot of these people, it is more an identity marker than it is an expression of actual devout biblical commitments to an actual religious belief, where you're bringing those core commitments to politics. Instead, it's redefining Christianity in terms of the Trumpian politics. And so in that respect, I think Trump is thinking, well, if I attack Pope Leo as being like a woke liberal squish, that'll help me with those voters who actually define their Christianity in terms of loving me. And for a few of them, that might work. But I think that like when it comes to any of the swing voters who came to him in the last election, you know, those peripheral to aligned with his own obsessed cultish voters, it is not going to work. And it's another example of him completely losing touch and I think in a downward spiral.
Three out of the four of us here are old enough to remember that the Beatles, who were tremendously popular, got a little out over their skis at one point yes, when John Lennon said that they were more popular than Jesus. And this led to a huge backlash across the country with DJs refusing to play their songs on the radio and, you know, huge bonfires of Beatle discs going up around the country. But anyway, so Bill, you had something you wanted to say about religion?
Yeah. Just one line about religion. I think, and this is not inconsistent with what Damon said or what you said, Mona, but I think the core morality of the MAGA movement is not Christian. It's pagan.
Yeah.
And, you know, and that is responsible not only for a deep split within the MAGA movement, but also to the extent that real Christians are taking MAGA seriously, to a perversion and a dilution of their own faith, a matter about which Pete Wehner has written eloquently for a number of years.
Indeed. Let us now turn to our final topic, which is how we think the Democratic Party is coping with all of this. The Democrats are the remaining small L liberal party in America, non-authoritarian. And so lately, there has been a little kerfuffle about the streamer Hassan Piker, and Democrats have been arguing about whether he should be shunned or whether people should try to reach out to his substantial audience of angry, mostly angry young men. We had quite a debate about this even at the Bulwark with people on both sides of this question. So, Damon, you've written about this. How do you think the Democrats are doing?
Well, I'm pretty divided on this issue. I mean, I can't stand Piker. I mean, I'd never vote for him or anyone like it in a million years. I'd gladly sit out that election where it was a Trumpian Republican versus Hassan Piker. I'd say, well, no place for me in this politics anymore. But by the same token, I do think when I wrote about this recently, I focused on institutions and just thought about how we are in this era where the old linear left-right spectrum has kind of flattened out in the center, and you now almost have like what the statisticians call like a bimodal distribution almost, where there's the right and then there's the left, and the center is sagging in the middle rather than a normal distribution, like a bell curve. And in that situation, our institutions with a kind of plurality, first past the post system, with primaries and so forth, it doesn't work well with the sorting that becomes necessary in that kind of situation, such that these decisions and debates about are we going to shun or invite Hassan Piker in have to take place before the election. So, like, we have to make that decision.
Well, and, we are having the debate now.
I know, but that's not great. It would be better in a parliamentary multi-party system where you could have the Hassan Piker party doing its thing, and then you have an election, and you see how they do, and then if you're the center-left party, the Democrats, we'll call them, they come in as a plurality victor, but don't have enough to form a government. And then they can decide, are we going to invite the Piker party in to join in a coalition to govern or not? And that is based on how well they did and their willingness to compromise with you and which ministries they're willing to take as part of a deal. And it's post-election, so it doesn't hurt you. It hurts. It can hurt the Democrats terribly to have any Democrat, no matter how left their district, which is the only people who'd ever want to talk to this guy anyway. You have to be.
No, there's a Senate candidate in Michigan who is campaigning with him.
Well, yes, but he's Muslim and he's running as that kind of a Democrat. So, yeah, okay. that is a kind of ally of the kind of politics he's practicing. But there are plenty of states in this country where a Democrat running would be like, I don't want to get within 1,000 miles of Hassan Piker. I'm going to lose. Mm-hmm. And the party as a whole has a lot to lose because we live in an era of nationalized debates. And any Democrat who goes with him is going to create fantastic footage for the Republicans to tar the entire party with this guy who loves Hamas and he loves Russia and he hates Ukraine and he's a lunatic who says crazy things. I just don't think I get hesitant when I think of like, should Democrats shun him? I would prefer they not do that either. Because the dynamics in the party are very unstable right now. There are a lot of young Democratic voters further to the left who are angry and are drawn to that kind of thing. And I don't want to preemptively say there's no room for you in our party either. So the Democrats are in a very typically Democratic bind, although a more heightened version of it because of our populist era. Now, I'm sure Bill will have plenty to add to this where he might disagree, but I'm eager to hear from Mona also on this. It's a hard thing.
We'll hear from everybody. So, Linda, one argument that people make is that actually the Democratic Party, the argument is, well, we need to reach out to these angry voters. We need them. And others respond, well, hold on. No, the way for the Democrats to succeed is to seem to be less left wing, to seem to be more moderate and win over some of the people who voted for Trump to be acceptable. And the presence of someone like Piker in the coalition is going to damage them electorally, not help. How do you respond?
Correct. Well, first of all, you know, let's talk about Michigan. We're talking about a candidate, Abdul El-Sayed, who is running to be the nominee of the Democratic Party for the U.S. Senate. He's likely to face Mike Rogers on the Republican side. And, you know, this controversy stems from Said deciding to invite Hasan Piker to a rally for him on campus. And I think that's horrible. I think he was, I think it's bad just because it's bad and immoral. This is a guy who's, you know, been a 9/11 truther, you know, for all the reasons we said. He's pro Hamas. He's horrible. You know, it would be like inviting Candace Owen to come and rally with you if you were, you know, seeking the Republican nomination. So it's bad on that level. I also think, as you suggest, it's bad
although he's
politics.
Not as crazy as Candace Owens. He's hard to be crazier as can be.
Right. It's harder to be crazier than Candace Owen.
Indeed.
Unless you're, you know, the president of the United States, he's getting up there. But the issue of whether or not this is good politics, it's also not good politics. I mean, Mike Rogers is, yeah, he's identified, you know, with Trump, and he's, you know, he's been a member of Congress and in influential position. And, you know, I suppose you can tar him as a right winger, but he's not crazy. And so if you want to, you know, if you want to seek the votes of Michigan, which went for Donald Trump in the election, after all, it seems to me you would be, just as a practical matter, not aligning yourself. And so if you're aligning yourself with Hasan Piker, I don't buy that it's because, you know, he has appealed to young people. I think it's because El Said identifies with those positions and he has not been quick to renounce them. So, you know, I think it's terrible.
By the way, among the things that Hasan Piker has said and stood by as recently as a couple of days ago when questioned about it is that he thinks Hamas is 1,000 times better than Israel. And if he had to vote between Hamas and Israel, he'd vote for Hamas every time.
Yeah. Was it Israel or Benjamin Netanyahu? Whichever. It doesn't matter.
No, I think he said Israel.
Israel. Okay. Well, Israel. Whatever. It's horrible. Yeah. Look, the guy is crazy. And again, you know, this deciding that the big tent means that you have to go to the very far right or very far left extremes and consider those people part of the big tent. For one thing, what it does is it drives out the people in the middle that you actually need to win elections.
Right. Okay. Bill.
These considerations are very relevant for a presidential election. They're much less relevant for a congressional election. This kind of behavior is absolutely typical of a country where different geographies and different communities have fundamentally different views. I am no happier about El Said's tactics than anyone else. But the argument that this is going to rub off on the Democratic Party in the midterms, I think, is not supported by any evidence available to me. Furthermore, I would be astounded if El Said turned out to be the nominee of the Democratic Party for senator in Michigan, and there isn't a single poll I've seen that suggests that he will emerge as the victor, because they're two perfectly plausible alternatives to him.
Yeah, but Bill, you know, you're trying to cabin this as just a matter of Michigan or just a matter of the midterms. But Hasan Piker has having a moment, okay? You know, Bernie Sanders went on his podcast. AOC has been seen with him. He's a good buddy of Mamdani in New York. I mean, this is not just, you know, something that's happening in Michigan.
Granted, and that's not the point I'm making. The point I'm making is that for purposes of a congressional election, we have to distinguish between our moral attitudes on the one hand and political predictions on the other. I do not think that this behavior is going to cost the Democrats severely or even significantly at the polls. The crunch comes not when you're choosing 30 some odd senators and all 435 members of the House. The crunch comes when you have to choose a single person to be your presidential nominee, right? And that's where the willingness or unwillingness of a candidate or potential candidate to call this guy out and to draw lines, you know,
sister soldier?
Sister soldier on steroids, that's where it becomes decisive. And so the question of whether this rubs off on the National Democratic Party is, to a first approximation, the question of whether the person who represents the party in the general election seems to be squishily open to this sort of thing or clearly draws a line against it. That's what defines the party. There, for purposes of party definition, there will not be no single party definition coming out of the midterm elections. So I'm not trying to cabin this. What I am saying is that you have to distinguish between two very different kinds of elections.
Okay. Well, I'm going to stay with you then for the next question, which is this. It's very early days and so much can happen, but what is your feeling about the Democratic Party in general, about their strategy for 2028, whether they are going to be inclined to nominate someone who's a moderate, whether they will have some of the spirit of 1992, right? When after so many losses, they nominated Clinton because they were desperate to win, and they understood that he wasn't every liberal Democrat's beau ideal, but they thought he could win.
I'm going to give you an erudite non-answer to your question. The Democratic Party is going to have the kind of rip-roaring open debate about its future that it did not have in 2020 and didn't really have in 2016, where Hillary Clinton functioned as Obama's designated heir apparent. And it's going to be a lot like 1992 in that there will be a wide range of options on offer for the party. Without breathing hard, I can name 15 people who are likely to be there at the starting line when the gun goes off. And how that dynamic is going to work out, what kind of choice the party is going to make, there is no responsible way of predicting right now. And a lot of it will depend on contingencies that are impossible to predict in prospect and difficult to understand in retrospect. So is the party going to nominate a Josh Shapiro? Or is it going to nominate an AOC?
Is she old enough now?
Just barely. And I honestly don't know. And a lot of it, remember what happened to the Republicans in 2016?
Sadly, yes.
If you have a bunch of people, vying for the same lane, and one person who opportunistically, occupies a different lane and makes it work, then the division of the majority can allow a plurality winner who is very different from the nature of the majority to win. If there's only one progressive candidate in the race in 2020, if Ro Khanna, for example, decides not to run, if AOC runs, as he has said he will do, and if she runs a good campaign, well, everybody else is vying to be the non-progressive alternative to her. Who knows? Improbable as it seems, she could end up getting 32% of the Democratic vote and win the nomination. I don't think that's going to happen, but I can't rule it out. So there is no way of answering your question. I will tell you this. A surprising number of Democrats, although maybe it shouldn't be surprised, desperately want to begin to bring this misbegotten era to an end and start in a new direction that offers a better chance to build an enduring majority. That I can tell you for sure. How they choose to act in the face of that desire, I cannot predict.
Linda, I am not, needless to say, carrying water for AOC. But one argument that I hear among Democrats so often that I think is wrong, and I'd be curious to hear what you think, is, well, we can't nominate another woman. That's for sure. We learned our lesson. Hillary Clinton, you know, and then Kamala Harris. So obviously it can't be a woman. What do you think of that?
I have for the very longest time, Mona, believed that when America elects a woman, it's going to be a Republican. And that has to do with people believing that Republicans are stronger on national defense and foreign policy in general. You know, present office holder is an exception.
Notwithstanding.
And so I would be very surprised if someone like it. I just can't imagine AOC being elected. I'm sorry. I don't consider her a serious person. She's a congresswoman and she represents her district. And I frankly don't know how well she represents, if she actually brings home the bacon and takes care of constituents' problems and answers their questions or not, which is what gets you elected to the House.
I really do think her youth is against her, honestly. She is
very young, and there's no chance AOC is going to be the nominee either of the Democratic Party, Bill, all your wisdom notwithstanding. I just don't see that happening.
I'm not predicting it. But I'm not ruling it out either.
But, you know, I think there is a possibility you will see. I hope I see a woman president in my lifetime, but I think it's going to be someone who's much more moderate, and I think it's going to be more likely to see it on the Republican side.
Okay. And do you think the Democrats are going to find a winning candidate, a moderate candidate who can win over some of the voters that will be feeling buyer's remorse about Trump?
The problem is, I mean, there are a number of people. Bill is right there. You know, Mark Kelly from Arizona is another one who's very moderate and running, I think, probably going to be running for president. The Democrats have no dearth of people who want to be president and who are willing to run.
Right.
The problem is they have to, I think, both be moderate and they have to have some charisma. I like Andy Beshear a lot. He'd be my ideal Democratic candidate. But one of the things we've always learned in American politics is personality, and I hate to say it, but it's true, looks also count.
They do. That's especially in the since we've come into the television age, honestly.
Right.
Yeah. Damon, what's your verdict?
Well, I mean, obviously, I don't know any more than anyone else, although I think that Linda, having lived through 2016, should not say anyone will not be the nominee. Because I swear Donald Trump became the nominee. I still can't believe it at some level, because I grew up in New York and I saw that schmuck on television all the time and on the cover of the New York Post. And then sometimes I remind myself of what has happened and I still do a double take. So if he can do it, AOC can absolutely do it. And I don't know if it'll happen, but I do. The only thing I would add, I guess, is that we need to keep in mind that in our era, a populist era, which it very much is here and abroad, the left-right spectrum, extreme versus moderate that we've been talking about, is one dimension of politics, but there is another, which is anti-establishment versus establishment. Kamala Harris ran a campaign in 2024, bless her heart, perfect for me. She ran a substantively moderate campaign that was troubled because of earlier, more extreme stances she had taken when she ran in 2020. So not everyone bought it. But she also ran a very establishment campaign. The message was, vote for me, and I'm going to give you the most lethal military America's ever had. America is good. The liberal international order is good. Our system is good and sound. Vote for me and everything goes back to normal, which is what Biden had run on in 2020. I think the Democrats, whether it's a more left-leaning or a more moderate person, need to run someone who can capture and run on some anti-establishment populist energy. And again, that's a separate question from left or center. You could totally run a kind of substantively centrist campaign that is combined with throw these corrupt, scummy bums out and also directed at some Democrats that, like, I'm willing to take on my own party when we're part of the problem rather than the solution. That attitude and affect, I think, is key to bringing in, even if it's a more moderate candidate, some of the left, some of the piker people, or if it's to the left, some of the kind of more angry centrist people who float back and forth between the Democrats and Trump and have over the last few elections. So that's my attempt to give a little advice. And, you know, everyone listens to me. So,
okay, well, here's my advice. I think the Democrats should be able to handle this. The fact is, if there's $5 a gallon gasoline, if your medicines, your fertilizer, your food, everything is more expensive for a protracted period because of this stupid, ill-considered, incompetent war, if a guy who is building a 250-foot triumphal arch and a ballroom in the White House for his rich buddies and is corrupt beyond belief, accepting airplanes and everything else, God knows, billions in corrupt grift. If you can't get a campaign out of that is successful, you should retire from politics. What do you all think?
Yeah, sounds good. I mean, although okay. some of those issues, like the war, will hopefully, God willing, be settled so long before the next presidential election.
I know, but the prices, the inflation may persist for some fairly substantial
$5
period.
Might actually look very good by the time the election rolls around. It may be higher. My grandson was visiting from California, and he saw. He paid, I think, $8 at the pump in Santa Monica. So
that's what the Speaker of the Iranian Parliament just said this morning, that, you know, that Trump is going to make you all nostalgic for $4 a gallon.
That's true. Yeah.
And diesel is even higher. Yeah, and that's like every truck driving
every
diesel
truck.
Person, truck, you know, it's just such a mess.
It is. But it is lovely to get to talk to all of my pals about the mess. So thank you, one and all, for joining me today.
Our pleasure. Thanks for getting us back together.